You're listening to the Diplomat's Asian Geopolitics Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Ankit Panda, and I'm joined here today by my colleagues at the Diplomat, Shannon Tiazi and Prashant Parameswaran. Thank you both for joining me. It's always great to have you on the show. And on today's podcast, we'll be discussing U.S.-China relations. As listeners might be aware, last week, Chinese President Xi Jinping wrapped up his first official state visit to the United States since becoming China's president. Xi and U.S. President Barack Obama, of course, met one-on-one back in 2013 in their so-called shirt sleeve summit in Sunnylands, California, and they've met several times since at various multilateral fora and the like. But Sunnylands and these other meetings, you know, don't quite get into the nitty-gritty of the bilateral relationship like a state visit does. So fast forward to last week, and things have changed considerably in U.S.-China relations. Xi came to the United States at a time when relations between the two countries are poor amid a range of challenges: Chinese cyber espionage, island building in the South China Sea, and military modernization. All of these issues cast a pall over the weeks leading up to the visit. Additionally, China's economically turbulent summer, which Shannon and I recently discussed on this podcast, by the way, you can go back and listen to that episode if you're interested in that topic. The economic turbulence took some of the steam out of Xi's sail on his way over to the United States. We also heard reports leading up to Xi's arrival that Washington was considering imposing economic sanctions, which would have been huge but didn't end up happening. And we'll get a bit into cyber since that was one of the major outcomes of this visit later. And earlier this year, obviously, 20 million records were stolen from the U.S. Office of Personnel Management, the federal government's Human Resources Bureau, by what are suspected to be Chinese hackers. So amid all these issues, it just wasn't, you know, the best time in U.S.-China relations for this state visit to be happening, but it happened anyways. So against this backdrop, Xi and Obama met, and they managed to pull off a moderately productive bilateral visit. And Shannon and Prashant might agree. We'll see about that. We didn't see major progress on a range of issues. I mean, issues like the South China Sea and the North Korean nuclear issue barely popped up outside of the press conference. The bilateral investment treaty, something which I personally thought would have been one of the main deliverables out of this visit, was left in the dark as well. So in the end, what did the U.S. and China accomplish in this state visit? Well, that's why I have Shannon and Prashant here to discuss that. So I'll pass things over to Shannon since she's our resident China expert and has and watched Xi's visit very closely. So Shannon, why don't you just tell us a bit about what you thought were the main highlights from this visit and essentially what, if anything, surprised you?
I would say the main highlight was the their progress on cybersecurity, which is not really a surprise. I think the fact that the Obama administration was emphasizing this so very heavily before the visit actually sort of counterintuitively meant that there was better hope for progress. They were pushing the Chinese very hard. The Chinese side really wanted this visit to go well. So I think there was extra incentive for them to come to some sort of agreement on these cyber issues that both sides could present to their domestic audiences as saying, look, we made progress on this longstanding, challenging issue. You know, it's easy to make fun of what they actually came up with, including the agreement that neither country's government will conduct or knowingly support cyber-enabled theft of intellectual property, especially as China's government has repeatedly avowed that it has never done so in the first place. So basically, China, according to its own affirmations, has promised not to do something that it has never, ever done and would never think of doing. But that being said, I think there were some significant outcomes from the cyber issue here. The first one being that they have agreed to restart cyber talks and at a higher level than the previous U.S.-China cyber working group, which was, you know, cast away when China was angry that the U.S. Department of Justice indicted 5 PLA officers on charges of commercial espionage. So now we're going to see an actual ministerial level dialogue between the U.S. and China on cyber issues. And both sides have also committed to helping investigate cyber incidents that are traced to each other's soil. Now, what this actually means in practice, we're going to have to wait and see how much cooperation each side is willing to give when it comes to these sorts of cyber accusations. But that they've agreed to do it is a big step. And, you know, there's got to be some accountability there if one side goes back on the agreement. Other than that, I think the other big deliverable that was being held up was the climate change agreement. And I do think it's very meaningful that the two sides both released a joint vision statement of what they want to see happen at the Paris Climate Change Conference. You know, that is going to be important for there actually being an agreement reached at that conference in December, that the US and China have now come out and said, we're on the same page, let's get this done. But the actual commitments made by both sides in terms of reducing emissions, obviously for China, the big announcement was the cap and trade program. That is not actually a surprise to people who have been watching China's environmental movements. I wrote a piece about this kind of explaining that this is a natural extension of what China's already been doing. We shouldn't see this as some major victory for the U.S.-China bilateral relationship. This is really just an outgrowth of China's domestic commitment to fighting pollution. And there's obviously a lot of other angles we can tackle where there was just as little progress as you would have expected. The bilateral investment treaty, which you mentioned, Ankit, as well as the South China Sea, there's not really much to report there. So overall, I think the summit was about as good as it could have been. And considering the state of the relationship going into the visit, the expectations were set pretty low and it exceeded them, but not by as much as the two sides might have hoped.
Perfect. Thanks, Shannon. I want to come back to the cyber issue and talk about that in a bit more detail. But before we move on, I do want to ask Prashant for his take on the visit. Prashant, is there anything that you want to add outside of what Shannon already said or anywhere that you maybe have a different take?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd largely agree with that. And I think the critical point is what Shannon mentioned last, which is the fact that expectations, and I think you also mentioned this as well, that expectations were set pretty low ahead of the visit, such that anything that was coming out of it that seemed substantial and positive was taken to be a major step. So cyber, I think, was a key one, and climate were the two ones that were focused on. But I also think, and I think Shannon mentioned this in her piece as well, there were other things that have been negotiated over the past few months, like in terms of military-to-military ties, there was the agreement on air-to-air encounters and a commitment to look into something potentially similar in terms of coast guards. That's pretty important. And I also think more generally, well, we can talk about the South China Sea in greater detail later, but I do think there were some at least interesting verbal things that were said, and I think the main thing was encapsulated in what President Obama said in the press conference, which was with respect to cyber, you know, we have to see whether the actions are followed by words. I think that probably captures a lot of the sentiment across all these issues, whether it's climate or cyber or South China Sea.
Right. So yeah, let's talk about the cyber thing a bit more. I think both Shannon and I wrote about the cyber issue ahead of the visit, after the New York Times reported that we were about to see some sort of historic arms control agreement on cyber. Obviously that didn't really happen. We saw these assurances that neither side would engage in, cyber espionage of the sort that's been, you know, that China denies that it conducts right now anyways. But really, I mean, it seems like on the cyber front, it'll be very difficult for either side to, well, I guess mostly from China, which has been the one that the United States has mostly had the issue with, to, you know, how is China going to abide by this cyber espionage agreement that it has with the United States now? I mean, we've seen China essentially, you know, this OPM hack, the recent hacks with a variety of other attacks. How do you guys see this actually coming into effect?
That's going to be the difficult part. And a lot of observers have pointed out that even the new cyber dialogue doesn't seem to be including officials from the People's Liberation Army, the PLA. And that is really the unit that's responsible for most of these hacking attacks, including against U.S. businesses for commercial gain. So there's a lot of questions over whether you can really have any sort of effective agreement if you don't have commitment and buy-in from the PLA as well. And there's always been a sense in China that what the foreign ministry says doesn't really carry much weight unless you also have the PLA agreeing to it and committing to it as well. At this point, I wouldn't expect to see a drastic change in the way China approaches gathering commercial information. There's always been sort of a very blurry line in China between what is hacking for national security interests and what is hacking for commercial interests, because China identifies certain sectors, including the high-tech sector, as a core sectors that it's in its national security interests to foster state-owned Chinese firms and make them globally competitive powerhouses in these crucial areas. So in that sense, I think there's a lot of sentiment in China that stealing trade secrets and giving them to Chinese firms is perfectly legitimate national security purpose, not for commercial gain in the sense of helping these firms profit. So it'll be very interesting to see how that language is actually interpreted in China. One other point that was interesting is that when Xi Jinping was making some remarks before this visit in an interview with the Wall Street Journal, he pointed out that stealing secrets for commercial gain and also government-to-government espionage were both equally illegal, which is an interesting position to take, given that the Obama administration has always said, you know, it's okay for a government to hack another government. That's legitimate national security information collection, intelligence gathering. It's not okay for a government to hack a company. And China was basically saying, look, you know, everyone knows that the U.S. very famously has repeatedly hacked other governments. And China was saying, well, that's illegal, too. And they definitely backed off from that position. You didn't see any mention of that in either the Chinese or the U.S. sort of consensus documents that came out of this visit. So it does seem like they're moving closer to a shared interpretation of what is permittable in cyberspace, but we're not sure how close together they actually are and how much daylight there still is in their positions.
Right. I mean, we saw that philosophical disagreement between the two sides come out really after the Edward Snowden revelations. You know, China is in the business of picking winners and losers in its own economy, while the United States doesn't do that for its own tech firms. Shannon, very quickly, actually, I wanted you to talk a bit about Xi's time on the West Coast, where he spoke to U.S. tech leaders. What was the outcome of that? Were you surprised by that?
Not really. I mean, that the whole reason that he started his trip in Seattle was because he wanted to start off on a high note by demonstrating the economic component of the relationship, which has always been less thorny than some of the other issues that were faced. You know, obviously, Seattle being the home of Boeing, which is one of the companies that's most content with its business relationship with China, sends a very strong message about the point of that stop. What was interesting was that he made such an effort to reach out particularly to U.S. tech companies and U.S. tech CEOs with his visit coinciding with the U.S.-China Internet Forum. I think it demonstrates that China is aware it's sort of losing ground with these firms. The shine of the massive Chinese market has worn off a lot under this barrage of problems, whether it's companies like Facebook that are outright banned from having Chinese customers access their sites, or other tech companies that are in the Chinese market like Microsoft and IBM, but are now facing increasing restrictions in the name of national security on how they can operate. You know, and I think there's some worry there that China is going to lose the support of these business interests. And they have been a very powerful force historically in keeping the U.S.-China relation going smoothly. Because if businesses have a lot of money invested in China and see that as a crucial market, they're going to want to make sure that the U.S. government doesn't do anything to really upset China and potentially jeopardize that market access. So I think she's starting off in Seattle and meeting with all of these executives was really a signal that, you know, yes, I do still have support in the business community. The economic component of the relationship is still doing okay. The message, in my opinion, was really overshadowed by all of these other economic issues that have been popping up repeatedly over the past couple of years. You know, U.S. companies are being more upfront and open about expressing their concerns with China and their reservations. And yes, you obviously have Apple very interested in continuing in the Chinese market. But at the same time, even companies that are dependent on the market are going to be willing to raise their concerns when their fundamental interests in, you know, keeping their information proprietary and keeping their source code to themselves is being threatened by some of these laws China's passed.
Right. And obviously, there's the flip side of China's economic downturn, which is obviously of interest to companies like Apple, which need high demand in China for their products to sell. But anyways, thanks a lot, Shannon, for that update on the cyber situation. Prashant, I wanted to go back to something you said earlier about the South China Sea. You said you caught a few interesting verbal commitments. Could you expand a bit on that?
Yeah, sure. So I think if you look generally at some of the comments of the press conference, it was pretty much a reiteration of both sides' positions. So President Obama said basically the same things about freedom of navigation, international law, and she basically said the same things about sovereignty and legitimate rights and interests. But I think there's two interesting things. So one I already mentioned earlier, which is within the broader U.S.-China military-to-military relationship, the agreement on air-to-air encounters is really important. But the second thing that was interesting was Xi's mention that, quote-unquote, China does not intend to pursue militarization in terms of its ongoing construction activities in the South China Sea. Now, you know, there's the caveat that many people already believe that China is precisely doing that. And there were reports that came out earlier this month that China was constructing another airstrip on one of its artificial islands in the South China Sea. So there's that caveat, but obviously a commitment to not pursue militarization, which the United States and U.S. officials have been seeking for the past few months with a view on China's artificial island building campaign in the South China Sea, is pretty significant coming from a Chinese leader. So I'm not sure, again, it goes back to what President Obama said, which is, you know, will actions follow on the words that are being uttered? But I do think it's significant that this kind of verbal commitment was made in this kind of setting, because I'm pretty sure that, and President Obama said this, that him and President Xi had pretty candid conversations about the South China Sea and the East China Sea. So this commitment, verbal commitment, is very interesting to my mind, at least.
Shannon, what do you make of that?
I do think that it's interesting. We've seen this before every time that China's foreign ministry spokespeople are asked about this construction. They have a long, long list of what these new islands are going to be used for. And most of it is very pointedly, you know, benign anodyne activities, providing shelter and logistical support for fishermen in the area, helping keep track of weather, you know, all sorts of things that have nothing to do with the military. And then they slip in, it'll be used to defend our sovereign interests, which, of course, heavily implies that there will be some sort of military function to these new bases. I think it's interesting that they made such a high-level statement, as Prashant points out. It's very, very different to have a foreign ministry spokesperson say this and then have the president of China himself say it. The real question is how you interpret militarization. If you interpret it in the narrow sense of, is China going to station anti-aircraft weapons or missiles on these islands, then I think there could be a good chance that she is being utterly sincere here. But there is no chance that these islands will not be used as sort of a staging zone or logistical hub for Chinese military and paramilitary vessels and aircraft in the area. There's no reason to build an airstrip on Fiery Cross Reef if you don't intend for your aircraft, including military aircraft, to use it. So it depends semantically how you define militarization. Is it militarization to simply build these facilities that have a civilian use? And I do think they will be used for civilian uses that China's listed, but also have a military use. And I'm sure many of China's neighbors, Vietnam and the Philippines especially, would argue that is militarization. That's probably not the sense that China's using the word in.
Right. I mean, China includes humanitarian assistance and disaster relief as one of the purposes for these islands. And, I've always thought about this hypothetical, what if, in late 2013 we had Typhoon Haiyan and China ultimately ended up providing aid in the form of naval ships. And I imagine, what would happen if there was some sort of major disaster in Southeast Asia and China had one of its military medical vessels stop, refuel at one of these new militarized man-made islands and then head over to the Philippines. Is that a militarized use of that facility? And, how does that really affect the situation there? I think that'll be an interesting eventuality. But I think that issue of how China semantically conceives of militarization is interesting and something that maybe gets lost in translation when, people like Xi are making these statements. Just to close off this podcast, Shannon, I wanted to talk about one final thing, which is North Korea. Usually we see North Korea as a sort of mutual area of U.S. and China's agreement. You know, they both call for denuclearization. They have their philosophical differences on what the preconditions need to be for talks with Pyongyang. Yet, after this visit, in either the joint vision statement or any of the fact sheets released by either side, you really saw no mention of North Korea, even though we saw verbal references to North Korea's military program. Do you have any idea why that's the case? I mean, Afghanistan received a significant bit of attention in the fact sheets.
I'm not really sure, except that the way that the fact sheets were framed was that these are areas where we have decided to expand cooperation. So they're really framing it as this is new areas of cooperation. The Korean Peninsula stuff might not have made the cut because there's nothing new there, but both Obama and Xi were very pointed in the press conference that they had discussed the Korean Peninsula and that both sides were maintaining their longstanding positions, that they agreed that the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula was a priority. Neither of them wants the peninsula to be nuclearized. And both of them, including Xi Jinping, demanded that all the relevant UN Security Council resolutions should be implemented, which is, I think, particularly pointed given that there's a bunch of rumors going around that North Korea may be planning another satellite launch to celebrate the 70th anniversary of the Korean Workers' Party in October. So there is some expectation that Xi and Obama would discuss that eventuality, and that maybe Xi Jinping would use this summit to send a message to North Korea. So in that sense, I think it's interesting that you had fairly brief but, you know, substantial words in the press conference and nothing from either country's outcome list of actual deliverables.
Mm-hmm. And I should just go back to the Afghanistan issue, which I thought was interesting, actually. Earlier this year, we saw, you know, the first Taliban talks hosted in Pakistan, and the U.S. and China both had representation there. So I think it's a positive sign for Afghanistan that both the U.S. and China are cooperating, since China obviously has a lot of leverage over Pakistan, which is important there. But anyways, before we end, I just wanted to ask you both about your impressions of where the U.S.-China relationship might go from here. Since Shannon just answered Prashant, do you want to start with your impressions?
Sure. I think obviously these kinds of high-level meetings obviously provide an opportunity to, if there are existing tensions, to sort of reduce them and focus on deliverables and opportunities for cooperation. And I think you definitely saw both sides work really hard to do that. And some of the very arcane issues and areas of cooperation we haven't dealt with here, but, you know, they include things like, you know, ocean conservation, wildlife trafficking. But the issue really is, if you don't have these kinds of meetings, you know, what is going to provide a sieve to prevent a descent into conflict, hostility, escalation, right? And I think the agreements that we talked about, like the air-to-air agreements, definitely provide some buffers in terms of preventing future conflict and escalation. But if you're looking at the relationship long-term, I just think there's no shortage of irritants, either regionally or globally, for the U.S. and China. So the only question is, you know, how they're going to manage that moving forward. And I think the issue will be, what will be the additional opportunities for cooperation beyond this? And, you know, the next opportunity for the U.S. and China to engage in a big way will be the ASEAN-related summits and summitry going on in November in Malaysia. And there, I think you'll see the usual issues come up, including the South China Sea. And those summits and meetings usually lead to some kind of divergence between the United States and China, and some efforts to then later say, well, yes, but we're trying to work on X, Y, and Z. So that, I think, will be the next battleground and, you know, will give us a sense of where the relationship is going, at least regionally speaking. Yeah.
Thanks, Prashant. And Shannon, you got the last word.
Yeah, I totally agree with Prashant. I think when you have a summit meeting like this coming up, there's a lot more pressure on both sides to sort of make nice, to come up with at least something, you know, something they can showcase and say, we made progress. You know, our relationship's doing okay. To use the example of cyber again, you saw the Obama administration repeatedly threaten cyber sanctions or against China, you know, to punish Chinese companies and individuals that may have benefited from cyber espionage and hacking into U.S. firms. Before the summit, that was a fairly effective way to say, you know, we're serious about this. We need to make progress on this issue because China didn't want the embarrassment of these sanctions coming down right before its president visited. Now, after the fact, if, for example, Obama decides to sanction China, there's really no high stakes reason for China not to respond. You know, the visit's over. It's done. And are they really going to have the same sort of impetus to keep their relationship on an even keel that they did have? It's tough to say. So I think Prashanth is right that how we can judge the actual state of the U.S.-China relationship is going to be how they handle these things after the summit, how they actually go about implementing some of the promises that were made, and how well they are able to cooperate on issues where there are, you know, very real joint interests and common interests, for example, in Afghanistan.
Right. And I guess I'll just add my two cents based off of your thoughts. I think, yeah, absolutely, you're right, Shannon, that there are a few areas that we can still expect deliverables. You know, in a way, it's sort of a good thing that this bilateral treaty deliverable is still up in the air to be delivered later, since there are these challenges with cyber in the South China Sea that, honestly, I'm still pretty pessimistic about. I think we'll probably see another cyber attack that can be attributed to China or China-sponsored agents. I think we'll probably see something like that maybe in the next year, maybe longer. But, you know, it's going to happen unless China is making some sort of major shift here with the PLA and its approach to the use of cyber warfare and cyber espionage. But you're right, Afghanistan, the bilateral investment treaty, how the U.S. and China act as global leaders on issues like climate at the United Nations. You know, today is the first day of the General Assembly's open debate, and we saw both Xi Jinping and Obama speak, and they both, you know, essentially demonstrated that the U.S. and China can still contribute positively to the liberal world order. And as long as, you know, they can still cooperate on these sorts of issues, I think there will be areas for cooperation, even as challenges persist. Thank you both for joining me. This was obviously a lot of fun. And for listeners, I'll include a few links to our coverage of Xi Jinping's visits. You can read about some of these issues in more detail. I will point out, though, that most of these are going to be from Shannon, since she was the one covering most of this. So anyways, thanks a lot for joining me, guys.
Yep. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks, Ankit.